So when the Buddha talked about Dharma practice, he talked about it as going against the stream. And you may have had a sense of that on this retreat, how this invitation to turn towards, welcome, allow your experience, to meet it with a friendly, kind interest, with compassion, is actually feels like it's pushing against our normal reactive habituality. It can actually quite feel like a struggle at times, that our normal way of wanting to move is just to act habitually, react. But also, very much in that line of going back out into the world, it's very much going against the stream of society, where fame, power, wealth, distraction seems to be what's most valued. But the Buddha actually directed us towards meeting our experience in this way, because there is a central insight, this sense that actually we participate in creating the world of our experience. Albert Einstein talked about it this way: when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Which isn't to say that they go away. That pain we have in the body may still be there. That emotional loss and grief may still be there. But we experience it in a very different way. And this is really what a lot of Dharma practice is pointing to. That we can actually, well, that we actually do create our world of experience. And you may have noticed that how when you meet other people, their experience of something that's just happened that you also experienced can be so different to yours. That their perception of what's gone on, their attitude, that how they met it, their conditioning and their reactive habits create a different world of experience to the world of experience we may have. And it's not to say one is right or wrong, it's just noticing this is what we do. So this invitation to meet our experience through compassion, with kindness, with care, with welcoming and allowing, is based in this premise that when we do this, there's the possibility of actually changing how we experience that moment. And this extends further, that it's not only the ways we relate, it's also the ways we look at our experience, so the perspectives we take on it. And we weave this a small bit through the retreat, and I'd just like to expand it a small bit through what are known as the three characteristics. So we've talked a little about impermanence, unreliability, and the third one is not self. And when the Buddha talked about these, he wasn't saying, look, this is how life is, you've just got to accept that, put up with it, sucks, you'll die eventually. What he was actually pointing to is when you actually tune into this, when you actually start to understand this in your experience, when you start to live from those perspectives, this also alters how you experience the world. So it's not about making life look particularly miserable or anything like that. It's actually about, look at this. When you engage this as a way of perceiving the world, when you engage this as a way of looking at it, of relating to your experience, what does it do? So when we look at our experience through the lens of impermanence, What it's inviting us to do is hold our experience more lightly. If things change, then why grab hold of them? We have this light touch. And Ajahn Chah expressed it very beautifully in this way. You see this glass. For me, this glass is already broken. I enjoy it, drink out of it. It holds my water admirably, sometimes even reflecting the sun in beautiful patterns. If I tap it, it has a lovely ring to it. But when I put this glass on the shelf and the wind knocks it off, or my elbow brushes it off the table and it falls to the ground and shatters, I say, of course. When I understand that the glass is already broken, every moment with it is precious. So when we experience life through this framework of impermanence, particularly the things we hold dear, we hold them more lightly, but they also become much more precious to us. We know that they will pass. We will lose them eventually. But while they're here with us, we really attune to enjoying them, to seeing the treasure and the beauty within them. And likewise with those things that are difficult, are challenging, what we're invited there again is to hold them lightly and to not extend them in time. Once we start to extend them in time, they become unworkable. But rather, if we hold them lightly, it's this moment. Can I meet it in this moment? Can I release that push-pull of reactivity in this moment? And then possibility arises. And that then also sets the conditions for the next moment. Unreliability is, in a sense, another way into the same thing. So if things are unreliable, again, we're invited to hold them lightly. We can't rely on them for any sense of ultimate safety or happiness or security. It also brings out that sense of the preciousness of things. And also it holds its opposite. Things that are difficult, challenging, painful, we also can't rely on those to be difficult, challenging, and painful forever. Again, we're invited to release and hold them lightly. Allow that possibility that if we can meet them just in this moment, there's the possibility of change, of movement, of some degree of ease and releasing. And unreliability also brings forth a question. If the things in life that we experience are unreliable, then what can we rely on? In the language of Buddhism, where can we take refuge? And we'll just leave that question to lie for a moment and we'll come back to it a little later. So the third of these qualities is not self. And notice the language there. It's not no self. It's not self. So again, this isn't some statement of truth that there's a self or there isn't a self. It's actually an invitation again to engage with our experience in a particular way. What it's pointing to that If we look closely at our experience, there's nothing we can find in our experience that lasts, that we can point to as being a self independent of anything else, that exists in and of itself. So the body, which we so readily think of as my body, as Nathan pointed out, it actually belongs to nature. But as medical science points out, most of the cells in our body die and renew countless times during our lifetime. Most of the cells in our body that we have right now were not the cells we had when we were 10 years old or 20 years old. They're not actually even most of the cells that we had yesterday. So our body actually is not the same body all the time. It's continuously changing. But our body also has a lot of non-human organisms. The big thing that is all current today is the gut microbiome and how our gut is inhabited by billions and billions of non-human cells. Non-human living organisms that we're actually interdependent with. They depend on us for the food for them to survive and reproduce. And we actually depend on them to actually support in the digestion of our food, to release a lot of the nutrients that we absorb that we need to survive. So much of this thing that we think of as my body can't really be held on to as me or mine. And as we pointed out in the reflective exercise yesterday, every sight, sound, smell, taste, body sensation, every thought, feeling, emotion, every word we've ever said, every action we've ever taken, all of them are gone. They can never be repeated exactly as they were. So again, none of these can be me or mine. And possibly that most intimate sense of me, that sense of the observer that knows all of this stuff that comes and goes. When we start to look closely, even that is not me or mine. This awareness, this consciousness. The word the Buddha used is more accurately translated as knowing. It's an activity. It's something we do. It's not something we are. It isn't a thing. And if you look closely, it's actually dependent on what's known. It arises with knowing something. So the knowing and the known depend on each other. They're not separate. So it can't exist independently as a me, as a separate self. So what this teaching is pointing to is that rather than thinking of ourselves as a thing, a self, this kind of separate, permanent existence, that we're actually more of an activity. It's more accurate to talk about selfing rather than self. And again, what it invites is a non-identification with our experience. So the N in rain that Zohar introduced, a way of non-identifying, of loosening that contraction, that grip that we have on our experience. when we can look at it through that sense of it, not me, not mine, it can release that. Again, not as a way of rejecting or creating distance, but as a way of actually seeing that there's nothing here to grab hold of. We can let the moment release and go so that we can then meet the next moment. So in the face of these three characteristics, in the face of birth, aging and death, of losing what we hold most dear, of not getting what we really wish for, of getting what we really wish wouldn't happen to us, of this body-mind that is highly sensitive and vulnerable, where do we find meaning? What can we rely on? Where do we find refuge? And it can really help here to distinguish between what matters and what's meaningful. What gives life, a life, any life, meaning. So of course our health and well-being matters to us. The health and well-being of those we love and care for matters to us. Our safety, our security, maybe articulated through home, through our financial security, through independence. All of these matter to us. But all of these are subject to change. They're subject to being unreliable. We will lose them eventually. So if we invest meaning in them, when they do start to disappear from our lives, we can often find ourselves left with a sense of meaninglessness, of pointlessness, despair. And Viktor Frankl beautifully expressed it like this. We who lived in concentration camps can remember the men who walked through the huts, comforting others, giving away their last piece of bread. They may have been few in number, but they offer sufficient proof that everything can be taken from a man but one thing. To choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. To choose one's own way. So what he's pointing to here is that it's our quality of heart and mind, our attitude, the way we are meeting life, that is actually what we can rely on. The only thing we have real possibility of control over. In traditional Buddhist language, they talk about this as taking refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Dharma being the teachings, Sangha being the community. So what might that actually mean to us in practice? Well, the Buddha embodies something. The teachings point to what it is he embodies. And what he embodies is what is known as the wholesome. The wholesome not being what's right or wrong or a moral judgment. The wholesome being actually what it is that leads to the releasing of that second, third, fourth arrow. What it is that brings some degree of well-being. what it is that starts to unbind the knots that we find ourselves in, that we create for ourselves. So the wholesome are these qualities that we have been cultivating over the last few days. They are what these ways of looking that I've just talked about. They are things that we can cultivate and actually bring into being and embody in our own lives. Not as some ideal, not as another thing to judge ourselves against, but as a real possibility and real potential for actually changing how we experience the world. But also, the Buddha discovered something else with this, within this. That when we embody these qualities, when we live through these qualities, it actually brings a joy. And again, just to hear that, how that word joy lands, one of these things that the negativity bias brings with it is this thing that actually something has to be five times as intensely pleasant to counteract the unpleasant. So when we think of joy and pleasantness, we usually think it as something that's actually quite intensely happy for us to really recognize it. And as we've been pointing out today, Nathan in his instructions and Zohar in the guided meditation, there's a subtle sense of joy that's available to us in our lives. A sense of ease and peace, contentment, calm. And it's this that actually becomes more available to us as we cultivate these wholesome qualities. And what we find is that these are available to us regardless of the conditions we find ourselves in. They're internally generated. They're not dependent on what's going on in our life. And this can be a real source of freedom. But also, when we live in alignment with these values, we also bring the potential for joy and well-being and happiness into others' lives. And you might have noticed that within this community of practice together, how our commitment to non-harming, to being a community of care, actually creates an environment of being able to touch in a sense of potential safety, of ease, of being free from harm, and how that can really support us in feeling more at ease in our own lives. So, there are many groupings and lists of these wholesome qualities within the teachings. And one of these family of qualities we've been looking at over the week, over the last days, has been what's known as the four sublime abidings. So loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and the fourth one being equanimity. And what I'd like to explore a little now is another grouping, which is known as the five spiritual faculties. And these five qualities of heart and mind are seen as a foundation, a ground for the development of our path of practice. They're a ground that actually supports the development of all other qualities. So the first one is trust or confidence. And this can really be one that a lot of us struggle with. I know it's certainly one I've had a lot of struggle with in my practice. Because many of us in the West are conditioned towards self-blame, self-criticism, self-judgment, low self-esteem, so this sense of not being good enough, or somehow we're deficient. This movement to trying to prove ourselves the whole time, to be perfect, to do everything perfectly. And this quality of trust, of confidence, is a trust really in two things. Our own potential, our own possibility to be able to actually cultivate these qualities, to be able to actually meet our experience in a way that loosens and releases that second, third arrow, that brings well-being and unbinding. But also a trust in the practices themselves. And what we start to find is there's kind of a feedback loop in this. As we start to engage in these practices, as we start to see that actually, when I do meet my experience with kindness rather than aversion, when I do actually align myself with impermanence, so I hold the experience more lightly, it does actually release that second arrow. It does bring some degree of well-being. And how, as we do that, it starts to build the trust that we are able to do that, but also that it's valuable in doing that. So again, this gradual increase in trust that we can meet our experience in a way that makes a difference. And there was a Zen teacher called Charlotte Joko Beck who talked about practice as the ABC of practice, a bigger container, that what we're doing is we're gradually building our capacity to hold more and more of life with kindness, with compassion, without reacting. And as we practice, we start to notice, actually, I can meet more of life in this way. I am less reactive. Rather than stomping off and sulking for 2 or 3 days, it might only last for 2 or 3 hours. You know, and really recognizing that's actually an improvement. There's actually something that's changing and growing here. So this growth in trust in ourselves and the sense of possibility. The second quality is energy or effort. And you might have noticed how it can feel quite effortful that we take up a lot of energy in trying to meet our experience and trying to meet it with kindness and with care. And what we actually don't often recognize is that the amount of energy we engage, the amount of effort we put into our reactive habits, they can feel so normal to us that we don't actually realize that we're actually taking a lot of energy and a lot of effort to distract ourselves or to push away and reject the experience. So as trust in the practice, as trust in ourselves grows, what we find is we naturally start to want to put more effort, want to direct our energy more to actually these cultivations. It just becomes a natural response from this growth in trust. But what we also start to find is, Although it takes a lot of energy to be mindful, to meet our experience with kindness and care, rather than just depleting our energy as our habits do, they also enliven us. They also give us back energy. So it becomes a bit more circular. We become energized by the practice itself. Third quality is mindfulness. And in a sense, mindfulness is the, we might say, the hinge point in all this. If we're not present, if we don't notice and clearly see what's going on, then we're just going to be lost in our habits. But also mindfulness has that element of recollection, of recollecting what it is that's meaningful to us, what it is we're trying to bring into being, to cultivate in any moment. So mindfulness holds, in a sense, the whole practice. It's what allows us to engage. The fourth quality is collectedness, unification, composure. You generally come across it translated as concentration, but I think that's a very unhelpful translation. It's as we devote our energy to the practice, as we grow in trust, there's a gathering together of our energy, of our body, heart and mind, a unification of the body, heart and mind within the practice. And this unification, this coming together of all our being, so that rather than finding ourselves that our body is doing one thing, maybe there's a pain, our mind is elsewhere, maybe on the holiday we're going to have in a couple of weeks' time to distract ourselves, and our emotions are maybe running off down the street trying to scream, oh, take care of me, take care of me. There's this kind of gathering of all of this together in a way that actually meets our experience and that brings a sense of well-being. So this gathering together around the wholesome is part of what brings this sense of well-being. And the last quality is wisdom. And we might think of wisdom here as an intuitive response, an intuitive appropriate response. So from this collectedness, from this gathering around the wholesome, and the meeting then of our core experience without that second, third and fourth arrow, there's the possibility.
Could you give an example of what you mean by that? Of the point you just made.
About the intuitive wisdom, yeah?
Yeah.
So, there may be a pain in the body. Our tendency is to reject it. Mindfulness is present, we notice that movement to reject, we find some way of relating to it. So it might be bringing compassion and kindness, it might be one of the ways of looking, but something that actually releases that movement into rejection, releases that movement into the second and third arrow, and then just leaves us in that space of where there's this I'm here with you, compassionate presence with the pain. And then in that spaciousness that's then opened up, where there's no reactivity, there's the possibility within that spaciousness from just this kind of intuitive sense of, ah, I could do this to actually alleviate this pain, this suffering, this distress. So when the reactivity isn't there, there's a space in which our own natural innate wisdom can find a response. Now what that response is very dependent on the conditions and what's going on. But it's this sense of trust. So all of these kind of feed back on each other and interact. So in that trust, there's a trust that actually we can trust the response that comes because it's held within a spacious awareness that isn't reactive. Does that make sense? I mean, the response may actually be, you know, if we're sitting in meditation, the response actually may be, actually, I do need to move. It might be that simple. Rather than actually just being with this, the most compassionate response in this moment is, I need to move. I need to take care of this. And to do that mindfully. In another circumstance, the response may be, ah, maybe I can go into this and start to explore, if it's not too intense, the nature of the sensations that this thing I've labeled pain and turned into something solid, if I can approach it and go inside it, is just this moving, fluctuating ball of sensations that shifts its shape, its intensity, heat, pressure, tightness, coming and going. So again, it's really kind of being able to tune into what's the appropriate way of responding to this situation as it is right now. And that, you know, there isn't it's always like this. It's that trust in that sense of, ah, this is how it is like at this moment. What can I trust into in my own intuition that is a response to that? But it's all rooted in that trust, the wholesomeness, the energy and effort and the gathering together, all being in alignment, if that makes sense. So, this cultivation, do you need more response? Are you sure? Yeah? So this cultivation of the wholesome includes many, many different qualities. And I'd just like to point out one more quality that is really, really important as part of practice, and that's patience. And when I was doing some research last night, I have an app from Tricycle which gives a daily Dharma reflection, and it was actually quite appropriate to this, so I think I'll read it to you. And it's from a teacher called Tara Brach, and she says, patience gives you joy in the process of waking up. Without patience, you may find yourself at war with your own forgetfulness or reactivity. So we do forget, we do react. That's part of the practice. And patience is what holds that in a way that we don't get into self-judgment, we don't get into self-blame, we don't make ourselves wrong. Forgetfulness, reactivity, that too is included in our experience. That too is welcomed, not to be rejected. So I'd like to say a small little bit about Sangha before we finish. And Sangha is often talked about as community of practitioners or spiritual friendship. But at the time of the Buddha, he actually encouraged his disciples to go and wander, often alone, and to find a place in the forest for solitude, but close to a village where they could go and be supported, gather food, medicine if they were ill. But to actually be alone. And the exploration of what connection means for us can be very, very important, particularly when we are faced with those really intense, difficult periods of our life, when we can so easily find ourselves feeling isolated, disconnected from ourselves, disconnected from the world around us. So how can we, even if we are in a sense alone, how can we feel into that sense of connection? And the teachings often talk about this as interdependence, interconnection. Thich Nhat Hanh, a very respected Vietnamese Zen Buddhist teacher, talked about it as interbeing. This sense that we're all intimately interwoven in a web of life. How we are dependent on the sun, the rain, the earth, insects to pollinate our food, for the water we drink, other people who actually sow the seeds and grow the food, who pick it, package it, deliver it to the shop where we get it from. The pandemic really showed how dependent we are on what we call the key workers, how our society is so interwoven into what they do for us, and how easily we forget that when things go back to normal. So this sense of our place in the world, in this web of life, even in our isolation, we are actually still interwoven, interdependent with others and with the world. And I alluded a bit to this yesterday in the tree exercise. As the leaf, how we are just one leaf among many, but at the same time, we are part of the whole. We are one unique, never appeared like that before and will never appear like that again, part of that whole. And we have these two ways of looking at our existence. That sense of being this small part of this huge universe, and that sense of wonder at the immensity of it, and almost a sense of our insignificance in that. And at the same time, there's been billions of years of evolution, stars being born and dying, the elements that go to make up the solar systems, the galaxies, the planets, the life on this planet. Millions and billions of years of organisms being born, reproducing, dying. And they all come to the point of this moment and our place in this. This universe couldn't be this universe as it is without each and every one of us. Each and every one of us is unique to it, is embedded within it, is a part of that whole. Even when we lose sight of that, when we lose our abilities, like the leaf as it aged and starts to wrinkle and can't do what it feels it should be doing, it's still a necessary part of that tree. So that holding of that paradox of how we're just one small part of the whole, and yet at the same time we are a unique and special part of the whole, and being able to move between those. Neither one is the truth, but which one actually supports our well-being in any moment? But both of them actually bring us into contact with that sense of something larger, that sense of something more, of the universe. And one way that many of us can really contact this is through the natural world. To really touch into and feel how we are part of that web of life. As a way of moving beyond that sense of isolation, of loneliness. Sensing into that sense of our interdependence, our interconnection, our necessary part as part of this whole. And Einstein put it this way: a human being is part of a whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. So we're always practicing something. In every moment of our life, we're cultivating or practicing something. We can be practicing our habits of reactivity, reinforcing them. Or we can be practicing ways of relating, ways of looking at the world, at our experience, that free, that unbind, that release that push-pull of the second and third arrow. And really have that possibility of changing how we experience ourselves and our life and the world. So we just have a moment or two of silence. So thank you for your attention.